Hello again, and happy holidays, everyone, and welcome back to the Talking Information Center. This is Rich from Situate, and today is Tuesday, December the 23rd, 2025. And for the next hour or so, I'll be reading news and feature articles from the Associated Press. And our first story today is headlined, Top Trump Administration Official Defends Partial Release of Epstein Files as Democrats Cry Foul. Written by Amer Madani and Adriana Gomez-Licon. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche on Sunday defended the Justice Department's decision to release just a fraction of the Jeffrey Epstein files by the congressionally mandated deadline as necessary to protect survivors of sexual abuse by the disgraced financier. Blanche pledged that the Trump administration eventually would meet its obligation required by law, but he stressed that the department was obligated to act with caution as it goes about making public thousands of documents that can include sensitive information. Friday's partial release of the Epstein files has led to a new crush of criticism from Democrats, who have accused the Republican administration of trying to hide information. Blanche called that pushback disingenuous, as President Donald Trump's administration continues to struggle with calls for greater transparency, including from members of his political base, about the government's investigations into Epstein, who once counted Trump, as well as several political leaders and business titans, among his peers. The reason why we are still reviewing documents and still continuing our process is simply that to protect victims, Blanche told NBC's Meet the Press. So the same individuals that are out there complaining about the lack of documents that were produced on Friday are the same individuals who apparently don't want us to protect victims. Blanche's comments were the most extensive by the administration since the file dump, which included photographs, interview transcripts, call logs, court records, and other documents. But some of the most consequential records expected about Epstein were nowhere to be found, such as FBI interviews with survivors and internal Justice Department memos examining charging decisions. Those records could help explain how investigators viewed the case and why Epstein was allowed in 2008 to plead guilty to a relatively minor state-level prostitution charge. Trump, who was friends with Epstein for years before the two had a falling out, tried for months to keep the records sealed. Though Trump has not been accused of wrongdoing in connection with Epstein, he has argued there is nothing to see in the files and that the public should focus on other issues. Federal prosecutors in New York brought sex trafficking charges against Epstein in 2019, but he killed himself in jail after his arrest. But Democratic lawmakers on Sunday hammered Trump and the Justice Department for a partial release. Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, argued that the Justice Department is obstructing the implementation of the law mandating the release of the documents, not because it wants to protect the Epstein victims. It's all about covering up things that, for whatever reason, Donald Trump doesn't want to go public, either about himself, other members of his family, friends, Jeffrey Epstein, or just the social, business, cultural network that he was involved in for at least a decade, if not longer, he said on CNN's State of the Union. Blanche also defended the department's decision to remove several files related to the case from its public webpage, including a photograph showing Trump less than a day after they were posted. The missing files, which were available Friday but no longer accessible by Saturday, included images of paintings depicting nude women, and one showed a series of photographs along a credenza and in drawers. In that image, inside a drawer, among other photos, was a photograph of Trump, alongside Epstein, Melania Trump, and Epstein's longtime associate, Ghislaine Maxwell. Blanche said the documents were removed because they also showed victims of Epstein. Blanche said that Trump photo and the other documents will be reposted once redactions are made to protect survivors. It has nothing to do with President Trump, Blanche said. There are dozens of photos of President Trump already released to the public, seeing him with Mr. Epstein. The thousands of Epstein-related records posted publicly offer the most detailed look yet at nearly two decades' worth of government scrutiny of Epstein's sexual abuse. Of young women and underage girls. Yet Friday's release, replete with redactions, has not dulled the clamor for information, given how many records had yet to be released and because some of the materials had already been made public. Blanche said that the department continues to review the trove of documents and has learned the names of additional potential victims in recent days. The Deputy Attorney General also, also defended the decision by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which Blanche oversees, to transfer Maxwell to a less restrictive, minimum security federal prison earlier this year, soon after he interviewed her about Epstein. Blanche said that the transfer was made because of concerns about her safety. Maxwell, Epstein's one-time girlfriend, is serving a 20-year federal prison sentence for her 2021 conviction for sex trafficking crimes. She was suffering numerous threats against her life, Blanche said. So the BOP is not only responsible for putting people in jail and making sure they stay in jail, but also for their safety. Meanwhile, Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, and Thomas Massie, a Republican from Kentucky, have indicated they could draft articles of impeachment against Attorney General Pam Bondi for what they see as the gross failure of the department to comply with the Epstein Files Transparency Act. It's not about the timeline. It's about the selective concealment, Khanna said on CBS's Face the Nation, adding that the redactions in the released files are excessive. He said he believes there will be bipartisan support in holding her accountable, and a committee of Congress should determine whether these redactions are justified or not. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York said on ABC's This Week that there needs to be a full and complete explanation and then a full and complete investigation as to why the document production has fallen short of what the law clearly required. But he stopped short of backing impeachment. Blanche dismissed the impeachment talk. "Bring it on," Blanche said. "We are doing everything we're supposed to be doing to comply with this statute." Next, in related news, judge chides Ghislaine Maxwell for mentioning victim names in papers seeking to overturn conviction. Written by Michael R. Sizak and Larry Neumeister. A judge on Monday scolded Jeffrey Epstein's longtime confidant, Ghislaine Maxwell, for including confidential victim names in court papers seeking to set aside her 2021 sex trafficking conviction and free her from a 20-year prison sentence. Judge Paul A. Engelmeyer said that exhibits included with Maxwell's habeas petition, which she filed on her own without a lawyer, will be kept under seal and out of public view until they have been reviewed and appropriately redacted to protect the identities of victims. Any future papers Maxwell files must be submitted under seal, the judge wrote. He said that he, quote, reminds Maxwell in strong terms that she is prohibited from including in any public filings any information identifying victims who were not publicly identified by name during her trial. A message seeking comment was left with Maxwell's lawyer, David Marcus. Maxwell filed a petition last Wednesday, 2 days before the Justice Department started releasing investigative records pertaining to her and Epstein, in accordance with the recently enacted Epstein Files Transparency Act. Maxwell contends that information that would have resulted in her exoneration was withheld, and that false testimony was presented to the jury. She said the cumulative effect of the constitutional violations resulted in a complete miscarriage of justice. Engelmeyer said Maxwell has until February 17, 2026, to notify him whether she plans to include any information from the so-called Epstein files in her petition and must file an amended version by March 31, 2026. Protecting victim identities has been a key sticking point in the Justice Department's ongoing release. The department has said it plans to release records on a rolling basis by the end of the year, blaming the delay on the time-consuming process of obscuring victims' names and other identifying information. So far, the department has not given any notice when new records arrive. That approach angered some accusers and members of Congress who fought to pass the Transparency Act. Records that were released, including photographs, interview transcripts, call logs, court records, and other documents, were either already public or heavily blacked out, and many lacked necessary context. The Senate's top Democrat on Monday urged colleagues to take legal action over the incremental and heavily redacted release. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer introduced a resolution that, if passed, would direct the Senate to file or join lawsuits aimed at forcing the Justice Department to comply with the Epstein Files Transparency Act. The law enacted last month that required disclosure of records by last Friday. Instead of transparency, the Trump administration released a tiny fraction of the files and blacked out massive portions of what little they provided. Schumer, the Democrat from New York, said in a statement, "This is a blatant cover-up." In lieu of Republican support, Schumer's resolution is largely symbolic. The Senate is off until January 5th, more than 2 weeks after the deadline. Even then, it'll likely face an uphill battle for passage, but it allows Democrats to continue a pressure campaign for disclosure that Republicans had hoped to put behind them. There were few revelations in the tens of thousands of pages of records that have been released so far. Some of the most eagerly awaited records, such as FBI victim interviews and internal memos shedding light on charging decisions, weren't there. Nor were there any mentions of some powerful figures who've been in Epstein's orbit, such as Britain's former Prince Andrew. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche on Sunday defended the Justice Department's decision to release just a fraction of the files by the deadline as necessary to protect survivors of sexual abuse by the disgraced financier. Blanche pledged that the Trump administration would meet its obligation required by law, but he stressed that the department was obligated to act with caution as it goes about making public thousands of documents that can include sensitive information. And he said legal precedent had long established that obligations to protect the privacy of victims permit authorities to go beyond deadlines to ensure that they are protected. Blanche, the Justice Department's second-in-command, also defended its decision to remove several files related to the case from its public webpage, including a photograph showing Trump less than a day after they were posted. The missing files, which were available Friday but no longer accessible by Saturday, included images of paintings depicting nude women, and one showed a series of photographs along a credenza and in drawers. In that image, inside a drawer, among other photos, was a photograph of Trump alongside Epstein, Melania Trump, and Epstein's longtime associate, Ghislaine Maxwell. Blanche said the documents were removed because of a concern that they might also show victims of Epstein. Blanche said the Trump photo and the other documents would be reposted once redactions, if necessary, were made to protect survivors. The Trump photograph was returned to the public webpage without alteration Sunday, after it was determined that a concern by some government workers that victims may have been depicted in the picture proved unfounded, the Justice Department said. We are not redacting information around President Trump, around any other individual involved with Mr. Epstein, and that narrative, which is not based on fact at all, is completely false, Blanche told NBC's Meet the Press. Blanche said that Trump, a Republican, has labeled the Epstein matter a hoax because there's this narrative out there that the Department of Justice is hiding and protecting information about him, which is completely false. The Epstein files existed for years and years and years, and you did not hear a peep out of a single Democrat for the past 4 years. And yet, lo and behold, all of a sudden, out of the blue, Senator Schumer suddenly cares about the Epstein files, Blanche said. That's the hoax. And Associated Press reporter Kevin Fraking in Washington contributed to this report. Next, Trump warns Maduro against playing tough as U.S. escalates pressure campaign on Venezuela. Written by Amer Madani, Regina Garcia Cano, and Emma Burrows. President Donald Trump on Monday delivered a new warning to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro as the U.S. Coast Guard steps up efforts to interdict oil tankers in the Caribbean Sea as part of the Republican administration's escalating pressure campaign on the government in Caracas. Trump was surrounded by his top national security aides, Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, as he suggested that he remains ready to further escalate his four-month pressure campaign on the Maduro government, which began with the stated purpose of stemming the flow of illegal drugs from the South American nation, but has developed into something more amorphous. If he wants to do something, if he plays tough, it'll be the last time he'll ever be able to play tough, Trump said of Maduro, as he took a break from his Florida holiday vacation to announce plans for the Navy to build a new large warship. Trump levied his latest threat as the U.S. Coast Guard on Monday continued for a second day to chase a sanctioned oil tanker that the Trump administration describes as part of a dark fleet Venezuela is using to evade U.S. sanctions. The tanker, according to the White House, is flying under a false flag and is under a U.S. judicial seizure order. It's moving along and we'll end up getting it, Trump said. It is the third tanker pursued by the Coast Guard, which on Saturday seized a Panama-flagged vessel called Centuries that U.S. officials said was part of the Venezuelan shadow fleet. The Coast Guard, with assistance from the Navy, seized a sanctioned tanker called Skipper on December 10th, also part of the shadow fleet of tankers that the U.S. says operates on the fringes of the law to move sanctioned cargo. That ship was registered in Panama. Trump, after that first seizure, said the U.S. would carry out a blockade of Venezuela. Trump has repeatedly said that Maduro's days in power are numbered. Last week, Trump demanded that Venezuela return assets that it seized from U.S. oil companies years ago, justifying anew his announcement of a blockade against sanctioned oil tankers traveling to or from the South American country. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, whose agency oversees the Coast Guard, said in a Monday appearance on Fox and Friends that the targeting of tankers is intended to send a message around the world that the illegal activity that Maduro is participating in cannot stand. He needs to be gone, and that we will stand up for our people. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign ministry started evacuating the families of diplomats from Venezuela. According to a European intelligence official speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive information. The official told the Associated Press the evacuations include women and children and began on Friday, adding that Russian foreign ministry officials are assessing the situation in Venezuela in very grim tones. The ministry said in an X posting that it was not evacuating the embassy, but did not address queries about whether it was evacuating the families of diplomats. Venezuela's foreign minister, Ivan Gil, said on Monday that he spoke by phone with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, who said he expressed Russia's support for Venezuela against Trump's declared blockade of sanctioned oil tankers. We reviewed the aggressions and flagrant violations of international law that have been committed in the Caribbean, attacks against vessels and extrajudicial executions, and the unlawful acts of piracy carried out by the United States government, Gill said in a statement. While U.S. forces targeted the vessels in international waters over the weekend, a tanker that's considered part of the shadow fleet was spotted moving between Venezuelan refineries, including one about 3 hours west of the capital, Caracas. The tanker remained at the refinery in El Palito through Sunday, when families went to the town's beach to relax with the children now on break from school. Music played on loudspeakers as people swam and surfed with the tanker in the background. Families and groups of teenagers enjoyed themselves, but Manuel Salazar, who has parked cars at the beach for more than 3 decades, noticed differences from years past, when the country's oil-dependent economy was in better shape and the energy industry produced at least double the current 1 million barrels per day. Up to 9 or 10 tankers would wait out there in the bay. One would leave, another would come in, Salazar, 68, said. Now look. One. The tanker in El Palito has been identified by Transparencia Venezuela, an independent watchdog promoting government accountability, to be part of the shadow fleet. Area residents on Sunday recalled when tankers would sound their horns at midnight New Year's Eve, while some would even send up fireworks to celebrate the holiday. Before, during vacations, they'd have barbecues. Now, all you see is bread with bologna, Salazar said of Venezuelan families spending the holiday at the beach next to the refinery. Things are expensive. Food prices keep going up and up every day. Venezuela's ruling party-controlled National Assembly on Monday gave initial approval to a measure that would criminalize a broad range of activities that could be linked to the seizure of oil tankers. Lawmaker Giuseppe Alessandrello, who introduced the bill, said people could be fined and imprisoned for up to 20 years for promoting, requesting, supporting, financing, or for participating in acts of piracy, blockades, and other international illegal acts against commercial entities operating with the South American country. The Defense Department, under Trump's orders, continues its campaign of attacks on smaller vessels in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific Ocean that it alleges are carrying drugs to the United States and beyond. At least 105 people have been killed in 29 known strikes since early September. The strikes have faced scrutiny from U.S. lawmakers and human rights activists who say the administration has offered scant evidence that its targets are indeed drug smugglers and that the fatal strikes amount to extrajudicial killers. And in this story, Garcia Cano reported from El Palito, Venezuela, and Burroughs reported from London. Next, a look at aging baby boomers in the United States. Written by AP's Mike Schneider. The oldest baby boomers, once the vanguard of an American youth that revolutionized U.S. culture and politics, turn 80 in 2026. The generation that twirled the first plastic hula hoops and dressed up the first Barbie dolls embraced the TV age, blissed out at Woodstock, and protested the Vietnam War. The cohort that didn't trust anyone over age 30 now is contributing to the overall aging of America. Boomers becoming octogenarians in 2026 include actor Henry Winkler and Baseball Hall of Famer Reggie Jackson, singers Cher and Dolly Parton, and presidents Donald Trump, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. America's population swelled with about 76 million births from 1946 to 1964, a spike magnified by couples reuniting after World War II and enjoying post-war prosperity. Boomers were better educated and richer than previous generations, and they helped grow a consumer-driven economy. In their youth, they pushed for social change through the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, and efforts to end the Vietnam War. We had rock and roll. We were the first generation to get out and demonstrate in the streets. We were the first generation that was, you know, a socially conscious generation, said Diane West, a Metro Atlanta resident who turns 80 in January. Our parents played by the rules. We didn't necessarily play by the rules, and there were lots of us. As they got older, they became known as the Me Generation, a pejorative term coined by writer Tom Wolfe to reflect what some regarded as their self-absorption and consumerism. The thing about baby boomers is they've always had a spotlight on them, no matter what age they were, Brookings demographer William Fry said. They were a big generation, but they also did important things. By the end of this decade, all baby boomers will be 65 and older, and the number of people 80 and over will double in 20 years, Fry said. The share of senior citizens in the U.S. population is projected to grow from 18.7% in 2025 to nearly 23% by 2050. While children under 18 decline from almost 21% to a projected 18.4% in that time. Without any immigration, the U.S. population will start shrinking in 5 years. That's when deaths will surpass births, according to projections from the Congressional Budget Office, which were revised in September to account for the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Population growth comes from immigration as well as births outpacing deaths. The aging of America is being compounded by longer lives due to better health care and lower birth rates. The projected average U.S. life expectancy at birth rises from 78.9 years in 2025 to 82.2 years in 2055, according to the CBO. And since the Great Recession in 2008, when the fertility rate was 2.08, around the 2.1 rate needed for children to numerically replace their parents, it has been on a steady decline, hitting 1.6 in 2025. Women are having fewer children because they are better educated, they're delaying marriage to focus on careers, and they're having their first child at a later age. Unaffordable housing, poor access to childcare, and the growing expenses of child rearing also add up to fewer kids. University of New Hampshire senior demographer Kenneth Johnson estimates that the result has been 11.8 million fewer births compared to what might have been had the fertility rate stayed at Great Recession levels. I was young when I had kids. I mean, that's what we did. We got out of college, we got married, and we had babies, said West, who has two daughters, a stepdaughter, and six grandchildren. My kids got married in their 30s, so it's very different. A recent Census Bureau study showed that 21st century young adults in the U.S. haven't been adulting like baby boomers did. In 1975, almost half of 25 to 34-year-olds had moved out of their parents' home, landed jobs, gotten married, and had kids. By the early 2020s, less than a quarter of U.S. adults had hit these milestones. West, whose 21-year-old grandson lives with her, understands why. They lacked the prospects her generation enjoyed. Her grandson, Paul Quirk, said it comes down to financial instability. They were able to buy a lot of things a lot cheaper, Quirk said. All of her grandchildren are frustrated by the economy, West added. You have to get three roommates in order to afford a place, she said. When we got out of college, we had a job waiting for us. And now, people who have master's degrees are going to work fast food while they look for a real job. The aging of America could constrain economic growth. With fewer workers paying taxes, Social Security and Medicare will be under more pressure. About 34 seniors have been supported by every 100 workers in 2025, but that ratio grows to 50 seniors per 100 working-age people in about 30 years, according to estimates released last year by the White House. When West launched her career in employee benefits and retirement planning in 1973, each 100 workers supported 20 or fewer retirees, by some calculations. Vice President J.D. Vance and Tesla CEO Elon Musk are among those pushing for an increase in fertility. Vance has suggested giving parents more voting power, according to their numbers of children, or following the example of Hungary's Viktor Orbán in giving low-interest loans to married parents and tax exemptions to women who have four children or more. Fry said programs that incentivize fertility among U.S. women hardly ever work, so funding should support pre-kindergarten and paid family leave. I think the best you can do for people who do want to have kids is to make it easier and less expensive to have them and raise them, he said. Those things may not bring up the fertility rate as much as people would like, but at least the kids who are being born will have a better chance of succeeding. And Emily Menyen in Atlanta contributed to this report. Next up, Medicaid paid more than $207 million for dead people. A new law could help fix that. Written by Fatima Hussein. Medicaid programs made more than $200 million in improper payments to healthcare providers between 2021 and 2022 for people who had already died, according to a new report from the independent watchdog for the Department of Health and Human Services. But the department's Office of Inspector General said that it expects a new provision in Republicans' One Big Beautiful Bill requiring states to audit their Medicaid beneficiary lists may help reduce these improper payments in the future. These kinds of improper payments are not unique to one state, and the issue continues to be persistent. Aner Sanchez, Deputy Regional Inspector General in the Office of Audit Services, told the Associated Press. Sanchez has been researching this issue for a decade. The watchdog report released Tuesday said more than $207.5 million in managed care payments were made on behalf of deceased enrollees between July 2021 to July 2022. The office recommends that the federal government share more information with state governments to recover the incorrect payments, including a Social Security database known as the Full Death Master File, which contains more than 142 million records going back to 1899. Sharing the Full Death Master File data has been tightly restricted due to privacy laws which protect against identity theft and fraud. The massive tax and spending bill that was signed into law by President Donald Trump this summer expands how the Full Death Master File can be used by mandating Medicaid agencies to quarterly audit their provider and beneficiary lists against the file, beginning in 2027. The intent is to stop payments to dead people and improve accuracy. Tuesday's report is the first nationwide look at improper Medicaid payments. Since 2016, HHS Inspector General have conducted 18 audits on a selection of state programs and had identified that Medicaid agencies had improperly made managed care payments on behalf of deceased enrollees, totaling approximately $289 million. The government had some success using the Full Death Master File to prevent improper payments earlier this year. In January, the Treasury Department reported that it had clawed back more than $31 million in federal payments that improperly went to dead people as part of a five-month pilot program, after Congress gave Treasury temporary access to the file for 3 years as part of the 2021 appropriations bill. Meanwhile, the SSA has been making unusual updates to the file itself, adding and removing records and complicating its use. For instance, the Trump administration in April moved to classify thousands of living immigrants as dead and cancel their Social Security numbers to crack down on immigrants who had been temporarily allowed to live in the U.S. under programs that started during the Biden administration. Up next, in education-related news, rural schools hit by Trump's grant cuts have few options for making up the lost money. Written by Annie Ma. In Shelbyville, Kentucky, when the funding for Shannon Johnson's job as a school mental health counselor came to an abrupt end 2 years into a five-year grant, she thought about the work left to be done. Johnson taught elementary and middle school students in rural Kentucky how to navigate conflict, build resilience, and manage stress and anxiety before a crisis happens. Few districts, especially rural ones, can dedicate a full-time role to early intervention amid a national shortage of mental health staff. But the Trump administration discontinued her grant, giving her a sudden end date. So when another job opened in Shelby County Public Schools, this one not reliant on federal grants, she took it. The district, 30 miles east of Louisville, does not plan to fill her former position. Without the federal money, it cannot. Federal dollars make up roughly 10% of education spending nationally, but the percentage is significantly higher within rural districts, which are not able to raise as much money on property taxes. When the funding is reduced, many districts have no way to make up the loss. Since President Donald Trump's administration began its sweeping examination of federal grants to schools and universities, millions of dollars for programs supporting mental health, academic enrichment, and teacher development have been withheld or discontinued. The Republican administration says the grants do not focus on academics, and they prop up diversity or inclusion efforts that run counter to White House priorities. Some grant cancellations have been temporarily paused during legal challenges, but for schools whose states are not fighting Washington's decisions, there is little relief to be found. That is the case in Kentucky. 9 rural school districts that received grants to hire counselors will have to decide whether they can afford to keep them. Already, more than half those counselors have left for other jobs. Federal money supports school programs for the most disadvantaged students, such as those with disabilities, kids learning the English language, and children living in poverty. Some is appropriated by Congress for bipartisan priorities, such as reducing barriers to education and improving youth mental health. In Shelby County, where federal spending makes up about 18% of schools' budgets, it also helps pay for teacher development opportunities, a key to staff retention, plus expanded after-school offerings that include tutoring, clubs, and transportation. The programs are not political, Superintendent Joshua Matthews said, and the funding loss only hurts students. I don't know about everywhere in the country, Matthews said, but I can tell you in Shelby County, our teachers show up every day to make sure that our kids are well taken care of, and we're not promoting anything one way or the other. Even current levels of funding sometimes do not feel like enough, Matthews said. The district could try to use state or local money to help sustain the programs, but at the cost of paying for field trips or keeping class sizes small, he said. For the counselors leaving districts that cannot afford to extend their positions, their youth mental health work is left unfinished. We had our minds and our goals and our plans really prepped for 5-year work, Johnson said. We can't really see a lot of change through systems in a year. The deep uncertainty has required educators to be prepared for an abrupt halt to their work while they look for ways to keep momentum, said Bridget Blom, president and CEO of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, which administers a federal grant for Shelby County and other school systems in Kentucky to expand engagement within the community and families. We have encouraged them to think about sustainability 2 years sooner than we would have, she said. In December, Blom learned that the administration would discontinue the federal grant. In Washington County, a rural district south of Shelby County, with roughly 1,800 students, the grant helped launch a mentoring program, a career exploration class, and expanded after-school academics. Schools with those programs have seen reductions in absenteeism, said Tracy Abel, the district's community schools director. As federal money begins to dwindle, the effects will not be immediate. Superintendent Robin Cochran said it may take years for districts to see the gaps that emerge from programs that end today. Eventually, rural schools run out of options. When larger districts lose funding, they may need to scale back programs. For us, it means that it goes away, Cochran said. Shelby County has used funding from the same federal grant to expand its community schools program, seeking out new partnerships with city government and local businesses for more classroom and after-school learning. In Simpsonville, when the city parks department noticed a shortage of fresh vegetables at its farmers market, the district saw an opportunity for Simpsonville Elementary School, just down the street. There, students in Katie Strange's class now learn about agriculture, biology, and ecology by growing produce for the market. Strange incorporated the work of the garden, germination, planting, and harvesting, into her lessons, while parents and community organizations volunteered supplies and time to build a set of garden beds funded by the community school's grant. Although deer ate much of the lettuce, Strange said the school cafeteria was able to collect enough leafy greens to serve the students for lunch, a highlight for the kids. In November, long after the growing season had ended, members of the school's garden club still spoke over each other with rushed excitement, recounting the harvest. Fourth grader Stefan Viljon explained how they treated the garden with deer repellent and listed out their crops. "We grew cherry tomatoes, regular tomatoes," he started to say. "Cucumbers," second grader Ray Lee Longacre interjected. "And we tried to make them into pickles." "They didn't taste too good," said Savannah Cull, a third grader. Nate Jebson, the district's community schools director, said that without dedicated funding for a role like his, the work to pursue such partnerships would fall to administrators who are already stretched thin. In Eminence Independent Schools, just north of Shelby County, Emily Kuhn hopes her district will be able to extend her role as a school counselor beyond the end of this school year, when the money for the position runs out. In her district, with two schools and just under 1,000 students, the grant-funded role came without the administrative tasks most counselors juggle and focused on working with students on their mental health and emotional skills. "It takes more than 1 year to build that with people here because they're a very tight-knit, small community," Kuhn said. "I've noticed a huge difference this year compared to last, of kids coming in and trusting me." The Ohio Valley Educational Cooperative, which manages the grant that funded Kuhn and Johnson's jobs, unsuccessfully appealed the administration's decision to discontinue that funding, said Jason Adkins, chief executive officer. The federal lawsuit filed to challenge the grant's termination temporarily restored the funding, but only for a subset of districts, not including those in Kentucky. This fall, the U.S. Education Department announced it would seek new applicants for the school mental health grants it pulled back. The Ohio Valley Cooperative reapplied, but was not awarded a new grant, Adkins said. Even if the cooperative had won the money, that would not have helped the staff originally hired. The new guidance limits recipients to hiring school psychologists and not counselors. In the initial grants, the organization focused on hiring counselors, in part because of a shortage of psychologists in rural areas, Adkins said. School psychologists require more training and are in high demand in larger urban districts. The goal was to hire quickly and start boosting mental health support right away. Even if there was the money to hire more psychologists, Adkins said, he was unsure whether there would be enough applicants to fill those roles. And the writer Annie Ma, who produced this article, is an Associated Press national writer who covers K-12 education. And in sports news today, Chiefs move to Kansas leaves Missouri fans heartbroken over another NFL franchise leaving. Written by Dave Scretta. The state of Missouri is losing its third NFL franchise and the second in the past decade, and the decision by the Chiefs on Monday to depart their longtime home at Arrowhead Stadium for a new domed facility in Kansas may hurt the most. The Chiefs announced their intention to move after Kansas lawmakers approved a bond package earlier in the day to help pay for the new facility. It will be built near Kansas Speedway and a retail district known as the Legends in Kansas City, Kansas, only about 30 miles from Arrowhead Stadium, but a distance that has perhaps never felt so far. "Years ago, as a kid, my family was homeless for a while, and we lived in a motel not too far from the stadium," said Quinton Lucas, the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, shortly after the team's announcement. "I knew we struggled, but I believe nothing was cooler than living within a stone's throw of what I thought then and today is the greatest stadium in football. Like a lot of parents in Chiefs Kingdom, my single mother scraped some money together to get me to Arrowhead for my first game. 300-level upper deck for a 30-7 preseason loss to the Buffalo Bills in 1993. I've been hooked ever since. Missouri lawmakers had been desperately trying to keep the Chiefs with their own funding package. They held a special legislative session in June, backed by Governor Mike Kehoe, that authorized bonds covering up to 50% of the cost of new or renovated stadiums, plus up to $50 million of tax credits for each stadium, and unspecified aid from local governments. Lucas also had been working with local lawmakers in recent days on a counterproposal to keep the Chiefs in Missouri. We understand our very fair but very responsible financial offer of taxpayer support was surpassed by an even more robust public financing package in Kansas, he said. The Chiefs have a business to run, and today made a business decision. We wish them well. The previous two NFL teams to leave Missouri were in St. Louis. The Cardinals, who came from Chicago in 1960, left for the Phoenix area in 1988, and now play in a state-of-the-art stadium in Glendale, Arizona. The Rams arrived from Anaheim, California in 1995, then headed to Los Angeles, in part because of their inability to secure funding to replace the dome at America's Center. The Rams recently built SoFi Stadium in the suburb of Inglewood, California, at a cost of more than $5 billion. Other professional sports franchises to jilt Missouri include the Athletics of Major League Baseball, who left Kansas City for Oakland, California, following the 1967 season, the Kings of the National Basketball Association, who moved to Sacramento, California in 1985, and the Kansas City Scouts of the National Hockey League, who eventually became the Colorado Rockies. Sporting Kansas City, a club in Major League Soccer, once called Arrowhead Stadium home. It now plays its games on the Kansas side of the state line at Children's Mercy Park, close to where the Chiefs are expected to build their new stadium. I feel like Kansas won the Super Bowl, said Ty Masterson, the president of the Kansas Senate. The Chiefs and Kansas City Royals have played for more than five decades at the Truman Sports Complex, where Arrowhead and Kauffman Stadiums sit a couple of hundred yards apart. Both are revered, the NFL stadium for its tailgating experience and loud home field advantage, and the Major League Baseball stadium for its picturesque backdrop of glittering outfield fountains. Both teams have had plenty of recent success there, too. The Chiefs, who at 6-9 have been eliminated from playoff contention this season, had appeared in the past three Super Bowls and the previous seven conference title games. They have some of the biggest stars in the game, including quarterback Patrick Mahomes, who has led the Chiefs to three Super Bowl titles and five trips to the big game. The Royals, who won their second World Series in 2015, returned to the playoffs following the 2024 season. They are led by Bobby Witt Jr., one of the bright young stars of the game, and are coming off a second consecutive winning season. One of the prevailing questions now is whether the Royals will follow the Chiefs across the Kansas-Missouri line. The Royals insist they will not play at Kauffman Stadium beyond the 2031 season, and their preference has been to build a new downtown ballpark. But a sales tax extension that would have paid for an $800 million renovation of Arrowhead Stadium and a new home for the Royals was soundly defeated last year by voters in Jackson County, Missouri, leaving both to look elsewhere. Through an affiliate, the Royals have purchased the mortgage for a tract of land in the Kansas City suburb of Overland Park, Kansas. The announcement of the Chiefs moving to Kansas generated widespread reaction among fans. Some were concerned about the price of tickets in a new facility, others about traffic flow and construction, and still others about the legacy of Arrowhead Stadium. "I don't think it is the greatest idea," said Dustin Allen, who lives in Blue Springs, Missouri, and was visiting Union Station in downtown Kansas City, Missouri, on Monday. "I think that where they have it is a very nice spot. I will say that the traffic over there is always fun. I think it's nice to have them downtown in some way, shape, or form." Mike Robinson, a season ticket holder from Kansas City, Kansas, was visiting a science museum inside the train station with his son. "I'm pretty sure prices will go up," he said. "That's what I'm concerned about. A brand new stadium. Season ticket holders may not be able to keep up with their tickets with the rising prices." Annalasia Miller, a Chiefs fan from Kansas City, Kansas, didn't have a strong opinion about the move since the team isn't leaving entirely. The new stadium will be about 35 miles west of the old one. "It's just whatever they want to do," she said, as she visited Union Station with her three children. "As long as they are still in our city, representing our city, that's all that matters to me." And Associated Press writers John Hanna, David Lieb, and Heather Hollingsworth contributed. And that's it for today's reading. Thanks for calling, and have a wonderful holiday.